the U.S.-Mexico border has been called a leaking wound by U.S. Poet Laureate Juan Felipe Herrera. In South Texas, that wound bleeds immigrants, violence, and drugs. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Author Stephanie Elizondo Griest spent a decade looking at all aspects of the border, religion, drugs, immigration, not just in her native South Texas, but at the U.S.-Canadian border as well. And despite being separated by 2,000 miles, Elizondo Griest found that the northern and southern borderlands have more in common than not. I had a chance to talk with the author about her latest book, All the Agents and Saints, Dispatches from the U.S. Borderlands. There are so many different characters and so many angles that this book takes. It's almost like every chapter could branch off into its own book. Mm-hmm. Like, you want to learn more about this woman with the magic tree. Tell us a little bit more about her, since I just brought her up.
Oh, the magic tree. Yes. So this is a lovely woman named Estela Palacios, and she lives in Concepcion. It's probably about 100 miles north of the border. And I heard about her from Santa Barraza, the very famous Chicana painter, muralist. And she had mentioned that there was a tree that spoke, and it had leaves that could heal. So I thought, all right, let's go check out this tree. So my buddy Greg and I drove down to Concepcion, and Estela greeted us, and she's like, go talk to my tree. So we did. We walked over to it, and it was very cold that day. So cold, you know, South Texas basically shuts down when it's below like 50 degrees, including it turns our trees. Our trees don't talk when it's below 50. But we pressed our ears against the trunk, and quite to my shock, I could hear a little bit of trickling water. And I hadn't actually listened to a tree before, so perhaps all trees sound like they have trickling water. But at the moment, it did seem like it had some significance. You know, at first, it just seemed kind of like an interesting, kind of quirky thing. But it really took a different turn when we were leaving. She made a mention about not being able to drink from her water well. And I said, what? And she said, oh, no, 14 years now, I have to drink bottled water from Premont. I'm like, well, what's happening to your well? She's like, it's poisoned. All the ranchitos around here, we can't drink from our water. I'm like, what do you mean? And she says that oil tankers come late at night and they dump their tanks across the street. And this was not something I was able to verify, but it was clear that she was not drinking from her water well. And certainly South Texas is surrounded by various forms of pollutants. I went in thinking it would be sort of a charming story about South Texas spirituality, but I came to realize something really intense, which is that women like Estela Palacios, who are sort of living off the grid, often don't get any help from the government. There are certainly activists that come out and help out, but often they intercede. They ask for divine intervention. Saints are the only ones that listen. Trees are sometimes the only one that listen in South Texas. And so that is what I found time and time again as I traveled for 7 years all throughout the border.
You actually were able to go with a Border Patrol agent. I believe it was in Falfurrias?
In Falfurrias, yeah. Oh, actually, Brooks County, yes.
And so while you were there, you asked to go with a Border Patrol agent to look for the many bodies that are left behind with so many people who are crossing over who don't make it. You actually are there with a Border Patrol agent when they discover a body. And I want to have you read an excerpt from your book, which it's a very graphic description of death, just so that our listeners are very aware, but I found it as a very striking piece of writing. So if you could read that for us, please.
Yes, and to further introduce this piece, this was the summer of 2012, which is the year that South Texas truly became a graveyard. 129 bodies were found in Brooks County, Texas that year. During the summer, they were finding a body or two a day. And I just so happened to be with the Brooks County lead investigator at the Sheriff's Department when they got the call in. And he turned to me when they got the call in and said, do you have a weak stomach? If you don't, you can come with me on the retrieval. So I did. I smell the body before I see it. The scent wraps around my face like a hot towel, burning my eyes, singeing my throat. It is violent and rancid and frightening. I start breathing through my mouth instead of my nose, but that transferred the sensation to my tongue. Now I am eating death instead of smelling it. Maybe 40 feet away, a pair of black jeans becomes visible, an occupied pair of jeans, stretched out in the dirt. 1 foot remains inside a sneaker, but before I can spot the other, I see the arm, what's left of the arm. Not long ago, that arm must have hugged and danced, carried firewood and groceries and children. It has been eaten to the bone. Just a few pulpy morsels remain. My eyes drift toward the midsection of the body. At first, I think it is wearing a child-sized t-shirt, but then I see the body has bloated to colossal proportions, so engorged it has exploded along the jean line. Slick black beetles crawl in and out of its crater. It is the face, though, that unravels me. From the nose down, its remaining skin is black and leathered, but the top half is strangely untouched, the color of bruised peach. There are deep holes instead of eyes, and the mouth is open, as if silently wailing. The hair is streaming all the way down to what used to be elbows, thick and black and damp. It's a woman, I think, and with that realization comes the overpowering urge to scream, to continue the sound her own mouth was making, to continue the collective wail they all must have been making before winding up inside the three-ring binders of Brooks County, Texas. Instead, I bite my lips until they bleed.
And this woman, her image haunted you for quite a while. And you actually kind of came up, were trying to come up with a story for her.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So she became the prism through which I saw everything for about 6 months. And that didn't end, actually, until I finally wrote her out of my eye prism during a snowstorm when I was living in upstate New York. Interesting, I've actually interviewed dozens and dozens of undocumented workers and their families. But this is a story that really haunted me because I didn't know how it ended. I didn't know how it began. Well, I knew how it ended. I only knew how it ended. I have no idea how it began. And she was so decomposed by the time we arrived to her. We didn't even know if she was Guatemalan, Honduran, Chinese. They could only estimate she'd been out for about 3 days. They couldn't find any identification on her. So I then began to try to think of what her journey might have been like. So yes, so I just try to track what could have potentially been her journey.
This book doesn't necessarily focus on the southern border, but on the northern border as well. But there's actually an excerpt in your book that I want you to read that sort of marks that transition from the southern to the northern border and the similarities that there are.
Absolutely, yes. Before arriving here, I didn't think the northern borderland could differ more starkly from the one where I grew up. Temperatures, for starters, tend to be 60 degrees apart. South Texas feels like a large wet dog sitting on your face. The heat and humidity are that oppressive. The North Country is more like a cat hissing and scratching you. And when I step into a car and in 20 minutes reach a bridge that requires a passport to cross and descends into a shockingly different economic strata, I realize I've been here once before. And when I read about people getting arrested for smuggling aliens by speedboat and drugs by snowmobile, I realize I am yet again living on the edge. In other words, when I stare around this remote new world, I realize I am home.
So in the northern border, you're going to the U.S.-Canadian border, but there's one particular community that you are focusing on in this book. Can you tell us a little bit more about them?
Yes, that would be the Mohawk Nation of Akwesasne. Some of you may recognize that nation. They were portrayed in the film Frozen River. I came to find out that Mohawks cannot stand that movie for really interesting reasons. It portrays their nation, first of all, as very bleak, very dreary, when actually it's totally upbeat in an empowered community. So I drove out to Akwesasne within a few days of arriving to the North Country for the year and was just struck by deja vu. It seemed like every story that I had found over 7 years of reporting in South Texas, I found the exact mirror equivalent happening in the Mohawk Nation on so many levels, from trafficking. There's similar economic forces at play there. But also what I was more struck in and something I really wanted to investigate was how Mohawks have attempted to preserve their culture, even though it was threatened so many times in so many nefarious ways, in particular by Indian residential schools. That was a system for over 100 years in which Native children all throughout the United States and also Canada were taken forcibly, often from their families, and put into these boarding schools that were often run by the Catholic Church. And their hair was shaved, and they were beaten for speaking their indigenous languages. So they're beaten for speaking Mohawk, for Cree, and a lot of these children were abused. It's the devastating legacy, and it almost ended the use of Mohawk, actually. But fortunately, there are, again, activists. I mean, activists are really what are saving the communities in both borderlands. Activists have attempted to resurrect the language. They've even started a school called the Akwesasne Freedom School, and that's done entirely in Mohawk.
When you're writing, and you're writing specifically about the religion and the spirituality, you kind of find yourself with an inner conflict between mm-hmm. you as a writer, yes. as a journalist, as an investigator, yes. and yet that part of you mm-hmm. that is still very basically Catholic mm-hmm. from your mm-hmm. upbringing. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about that internal struggle.
The Aztecs actually coined this term, Napantla. That's the state of living in between, what it means to live between worlds, what it means to walk between worlds. And I guess I've just tried to come to a sense of peace that I straddle many, many different worlds, not only between the Mexican world and the white world because I have biracial parents, but also the fine line between journalism and activism, the fine line between an agnostic and a Catholic, the fine line between a cowgirl and, you know, a really metropolitan person that has to be in the city, urban girl, you know. Yeah, I walk between all of those lines, and I think that that's one of the many things this book taught me is to just understand that that is what it means to be a member of the borderlands. We are living in the fissures of it. My intention with this book, before, when it began in 2007, was to try to find a way to fuse. And I feel that I did just by recognizing that that is the struggle that we all share in the borderlands, not only the southern borderlands, but the northern borderlands. We're all trying to strive for what it means to live in the land of in between.
That was my conversation with author Stephanie Elizondo Grist on her latest book, All the Agents and Saints, Dispatches from the U.S. Borderlands. Coming up on Fronteras, a very timely play about DACA.
Deferred action essentially means deferred deportation.
We'll explore that story and the latest on SB4 after this. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. SB4, the new Texas legislation that critics call the Show Me Your Papers law, remains on hold through November 6th. Texas Public Radio's Ryan Poppy has the latest on Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton's appeal of the injunction against the Sanctuary Cities law that kept it from being enforced September 1st.
The Fifth Circuit panel agreed to expedite Paxton's request for an appeal of San Antonio U.S. District Judge Orlando Garcia's decision. The court agreed to begin hearing oral arguments on September 22nd. Paxton also requested an emergency stay of Judge Garcia's decision to temporarily block the law from being implemented. Paxton argued, for public safety reasons, the law should be allowed to take effect immediately. But the court denied the request. Some advocacy groups criticized the move, stating that it would cause even more confusion and fear during the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey. Luis Vera is a plaintiff's attorney for the city of El Ceniso and El Paso.
Look, the reality is people are very, very scared.
Jackson County Sheriff Andy Lauterbach, the legislative director for the Texas Sheriff's Association, says his heart goes out to those affected by the storm, but the law should be implemented immediately.
The public safety aspect still remains. If someone commits a local crime and has outstanding charges from the immigration aspect of our law, there is your public safety aspect.
Though the court will begin hearing oral arguments in the case, the panel of judges agreed the lower court's temporary injunction of the law will remain in place until after November 6th. Ryan Poppy, Texas Public Radio News.
The sanctuary city's ban in Texas would punish local officials if they prevent a police officer from inquiring about a person's immigration status. Local law enforcement leaders could also be fined, go to jail, and be removed from office if they don't honor all federal immigration detainer requests. To combat laws like SB 4, the Mexican-American Legislative Caucus this week launched a multi-state campaign titled Not in My State. State Representative Mary Gonzalez, an El Paso Democrat, says the campaign will also help fight similar sanctuary city bills being discussed by other state legislatures.
There will be op-eds, conversations, policies, resolutions to make sure that that this policy doesn't go to other states.
The Not in My State campaign is designed to point out the economic impacts of the state's ban on sanctuary cities and the phase-out of the Obama-era federal immigration program known as DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, that protects undocumented children. A stage play that premiered last year in Dallas has become incredibly timely. The drama, called Deferred Action, is going on tour to Denton, Houston, and Los Angeles. KERA's Jerome Weeks has more.
Would be protected. This Congress won't pass it.
This is a scene from the stage play, Deferred Action. A young immigration activist named Javier is on a TV talk show panel. Javier's parents brought him to the U.S. as a child. He's a so-called dreamer, protected from being deported under DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. But he wants real change, not the limited status he gets from DACA. So on the panel, that pits Javier against both the Republican representative and the female Democrat.
That would help protect...
Deferred action is just a written excuse to turn a blind eye to people breaking the law.
I agree with him. I'm not saying deferred action is illegal. I'm saying it's meaningless.
But you can go to work, go to college without fear of deportation.
Sure, until they elect someone else and they throw it out. The time for deferred action is over. It's time for real legislation.
Sounds like the play was written straight from last week's headlines. President Trump is throwing out deferred action, and he told Congress it's their job to come up with legislation for undocumented immigrants. But playwrights David Lozano and Lee Troll actually wrote that scene 3 years ago. Katamia Theater and the Dallas Theater Center premiered Deferred Action last year. Lozano is the artistic director of Katamia.
The play still resonates because we're still looking at dreamers living with deferred action. Deferred action essentially means deferred deportation.
This week, Lozano starts a regional tour of Deferred Action. It opens at SMU, then travels to Denton, Houston, and Los Angeles. On tour, Deferred Action may get attention because it is so timely. It deals with one of Washington's most persistent political logjams.
It talks about the political games that our congressional representatives play with human lives, as we've seen with nobody wanting to take action on any sort of immigration reform bill for so many years.
Jose Manuel Santoyo is Carnamia's head of marketing. He's 25, has lived in the U.S. for 16 years, and has graduated from SMU. DACA never granted him U.S. citizenship, but...
DACA gave us a work permit, gave us a driver's license, and gave us a Social Security number. And that allowed me to start a career in not only public service and politics, but also now the arts.
Yet all of that could go away. DACA was set up to be temporary. It requires people to reapply for legal status every 2 years. But over the next 6 months, the Trump administration will wind down those renewals. After that, all the dreamers could be deported.
We always knew that this program wasn't permanent, but we never expected it to come to an end the way it did through this administration.
Lozano says this ticking clock, this legal limbo, was what interested him in the dreamers as a subject for a play.
I've been looking at the dreamers' frustrations with Congress's inability to pass reform, beginning with the failed DREAM Act in 2010. When Democratic representatives voted against it. That was a crushing blow to the movement.
For a dramatic complication, the two playwrights invented a presidential candidate, a conservative Republican who flips his agenda and campaigns for immigration reform. That leaves Javier, our young dreamer activist, facing a serious dilemma. Does he support a Democrat who's taken the Latino vote for granted, or does he support a Republican whose other stands he finds appalling, but who could actually deliver full citizenship? Of course, in real life, Donald Trump won the presidency by attacking immigrants, calling many of them rapists, demanding a wall be built along the border. So last year, that dramatic dilemma in deferred action was looking improbable, until Trump's announcement last week. Now, some Senate Republicans are talking about dusting off the DREAM Act, and Karamia's play has gained a pointed relevance. Liz Magallanes is an actor in deferred action and a Dreamer activist.
I'm excited to see this new whole other dimension that is added to this, and I'm really excited for people to see that sometimes you do have to make hard choices.
When I saw our first run through, I really felt this play has muscle. This cast is really inspired, and they want to speak to the political moment.
And that moment, as they've seen, can be a moving target.
For Fronteras, I'm Jerome Weeks in Dallas.
And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Michelle Dubach is our executive producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.